Blog Talk Radio.
Talking about Eastern Airlines every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on your computer's internet dial, www.ealradioshow.com, or at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. You can also reach us by telephone by calling 213-816-1611. Or toll-free at 877-572-1861. The hosts for the radio show are from many different locations, the south of Florida, the north of Florida, and in the middle of Florida, North Carolina, New York, Pennsylvania, and on occasion when I'm up there, Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Before we introduce our host, our producer has an appropriate, usable sound for this show. Mr. Producer.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jim, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and host. I've selected this little song, but before we play our song, let's start the show with this sound.
Clear.
Okay, sounds like the engine's running, and now let's listen to this nice sound.
Those magnificent men in their flying machines. team. They go up in the up up, they go down in the up down. Those magnificent men, those magnificent men, those magnificent men in the flying machine.
Well, that was just great. Ladies and gentlemen, our host for tonight's broadcast includes Neil Holland, who is our producer and engineer in beautiful Ponte Vedra, Florida. That's up near St. Augustine in Jacksonville. Hello, Neil. How are things in the greater Jacksonville area today?
Just absolutely beautiful today, like most of the southeast, I suppose. I'm now the proud owner of a home once again. We've kind of been living in an apartment, three-bedroom apartment, but most of it occupied with our furniture. And now we're going to take that furniture and put it in a brand spanking new home in a beautiful area known as the World Golf Village. So we're very anxious to get settled in, and I think it'll take about a week. But with the beautiful weather we're having, I think we'll enjoy our move. So, everything is fine here in Ponte Vedra, Jacksonville, and St. Augustine.
Thank you very much, Neil. And now we go up to Roaring Gap, North Carolina, where Steve Thompson does his host duties. Are you able to get out on the golf course yet, Steve?
Well, yes, Jim. Today would have been the first day that we've been able to get on the golf course, but I wasn't able to get out there. But it was absolutely beautiful. Temperature now is 67 degrees. We had 3-day wind warning last Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And a neighbor of mine told me that she saw on her anemometer peak wind gust of 66 miles an hour twice on Saturday. So we have had some awfully, awfully strong winds. And temperatures down in the high 30s and low 40s. But today was absolutely beautiful. No wind, 67 degrees. So come on up to see us in Roaring Gap. Jim.
Thank you very much, Steve. Now we're going to go to the center of Florida, a place called the Villages. Chuck Albright is there. It's called the Land of Golf. And I think you mentioned earlier, Chuck, that it was so crowded on the course you had trouble getting on today. Is that right?
That's correct. In fact, I didn't even get on at all. But I got a tee time come up later this week, so I'm going to be out there. I'm just going to copy Steve. It was a beautiful day, 77 degrees. Going to go down to a balmy 51 tonight, partly cloudy. Tomorrow is going to be better, 82 for the day and 54 at night and all sunny. So we are just so happy here in the Land of Golf. And if any of you people out there want to find a great place to retire, just get a hold of me and I will send you a CD and a DVD that will really knock your socks off. Take it away.
Thank you very much, Chuck. Now we're going to go a little bit south of where I am here in West Palm Beach. We're going to go to Boca Raton, where Cecile is located. And how are things in the Boca area, Cecile?
Well, the weather is great, but believe it or not, in South Florida, I'm nursing a cold. Could you believe that? So if I start not sounding good, Charlie will take over the script tonight. Today it's 75 degrees, and it's going to be 66 at night.
All right. We had, here in West Palm Beach, we had just 57 degrees last night, and it was in the low 50s along Lake Okeechobee, I understand. John Ruth is up in the Philadelphia area, and John is our travel expert. How's the new website for travel coming along, John?
It's up and running, Jim, www.fly-eastern.com. All you'd ever want to know about travel and all the information you could possibly get is on there. And it was a beautiful sunny and 60 degrees today in Philadelphia, believe it or not. A little bit of wind, but the trend is upward. So looking forward to a nice, easy spring for the next couple of months, and then we'll get the hot, sweltering heat of the summer.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much, John. Now, that leaves me, Jim Hart. I'm here in the West Palm Beach, Florida area, where the weather today was about 75 degrees, a little bit of a cool breeze blowing, but I really appreciate it because I don't like that hot, sweltering stuff. So, Neil, how about telling our listeners what our show is about tonight? I bet since the opening music selected, it has something to do with our show tonight.
Well, it's a potpourri. Is that the word? The correct word? It's kind of a little pot of a lot of different things, and we'll see what we can do tonight. But first of all, Cecile, you are in real estate there in Boca Raton, and I'm in real estate here in the Jacksonville area. And Chuck sounds like he's in real estate in Central Florida. Hey, Chuck, if you want a real estate license, let me know, and I can have you raise your right hand and swear after me, and because I have a school here. I run a real estate school.
So, all I need to do is sell one of these houses up here, and I'll be able to fly anywhere.
Cecile, how
about
it?
We have South Florida covered with Remax Advantage Plus, and Neil, you have Northern Florida covered with your company name is?
St. John's Realty Group, right here on the beautiful
St. John's
River. As most people know, it's one of the few rivers that flow from south to north.
Well, the real estate market down here in southeast Florida, Fort Lauderdale area, is just, and Boca Raton is very hot. There's very little inventory. We put a condo for sale on that overlooks the ocean. Kind of hard time there waiting for the customer overlooking the ocean. Anyway, it's under contract. It's under $500,000, and it was only on the market for 3 days. So it is a hot market here in South Florida.
Very good, very good. You know, our other host, George, Jen, our Arthur, is George, you're not with us tonight, are you? Oh, we do have a area code 609, so area code 609, would you like to make a comment, identify yourself?
That's New Jersey, I think, Neil.
Oh, okay. Yep. Well, yeah?
It's New Jersey.
Okay, New Jersey, welcome aboard.
Is that Tom Gallagher up there?
Tom, to press 1.
Yeah, well, I've got his microphone open, so if he'd like to join our conversation. But I've always wondered how much these airplanes cost these days. I remember when we got such good deals with Eastern Airlines on the Airbus A320, and I remember Frank Borman coming and telling all the pilots at the meetings that he went around the various bases talking about how we ought to face east and bow down a couple of times to Airbus because we got such a good deal on those airplanes. But I guess since then, the price of flying airplanes has really gone up. Steve, do you have any idea what a 777 cost?
Yes, Neil, I do, and I have a question. I don't know why it cost $320 million, but I'm going to recount an article written by Paul Osick, written March 29, 2014, and it talks about the Malaysian Airlines plane that has disappeared on a scheduled flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, and which, by the way, according to reports, none of it has been located in the area that they think it is, that it went down in the South China Sea. And it is a 777-200ER made by Boeing, of course. The 777 family of planes itself is Boeing's best-selling dual-aisle two-engine airplane. Through the end of February, Boeing has delivered a total of 422 of the 777 200 extended range or 200 ERs, including 15 to Malaysian Airlines. 370 planes on order from the 7770 family. None is a 777-200ER. The company ordered its first 777-200 United Airlines in May 1965, and the airplane went into service the following month. The first extended range, or ER model, the 777-200ER, was delivered to and put in service by British Airways in February 1997. A list price today on the 777-200ER would cost $261.5 million and would be the lowest priced model of the 777 family. Now, Boeing's order book concurrently includes 257 new 777-300ER models and 400 777F or freighters and 66 777X models. Now, the list price for the 777-300ER is $320.2 million. That's nearly $71 million more than the two-engine 787-9, which Boeing announced last summer, for which the company has taken orders for 404 airplanes. The 777 includes 3 million parts that come from 500 suppliers around the world. Boeing uses suppliers for the 777-200ER's two engines from General Electric, Pratt & Whitney, and that's a subsidiary of United Technologies Corporation, a London-based Rolls-Royce. A 777-300ER uses two GE engines, each of which develops 115,540 pounds of thrust. The 777ER has a maximum cruising range of just over 6,000 miles, while the -300ER's range is listed at slightly more than 9,100 miles. Now, the cruising speed is 560 miles an hour, and the maximum speed is 590. And the plane's maximum cruising altitude is 43,100 feet. Now, according to Boeing, a lightly loaded 777 can accelerate from 0 to 60 miles per hour in less than 6 seconds. Now, that's not exactly McLaren P1 speeds, about 2.1 seconds, but an empty 777 weighs 150 tons. What makes the airplane so expensive? Well, the 777-300ER can carry 365 passengers compared with the 787-9's capacity of 280. The GE engines on the 777 model develop 62% more thrust than the 787's two engines. The plane is also longer than the Dreamliner, which has a greater wingspan and a greater wing area, and is taller. The maximum takeoff weight of the 777-300ER is 114 tons greater than the 787-9. Now, when the new composite wing is added to the 777X, the list price on the plane will rise to $349.8 million for the 777-8X, which can carry 350 passengers, and to $377.2 million to the 777-9X, which has a capacity for 400 passengers. The list price is usually the starting point in negotiations between an airplane maker and a customer. The actual selling price may be 20 to 30% lower or more, according to Laham News and Comment. The 787 surpasses the 777 in maximum range, around 9,750 miles to just under 9,100 miles, and fuel efficiency. For long flights, the 787, which replaces the discontinued 767, is likely a better choice, mainly because it's more fuel efficient. But the 777 family will not be cannibalized by the 787 Far from it.
You know, Steve,
Jim.
Steve, I've got a couple of comments about that. And first of all, you remember when we first got the 727? I think it was the year 1964 or 5, and the Series 100 airplane. And we had the, we had the Pratt & Whitney airplane, the engines. And as I recall, they developed about 13 to 16,000 pounds of thrust per engine. So making it, I want to say it was 16,000 pounds of thrust per engine, those JT8, whatever they were, dashes. Chuck, you probably remember. But putting all three of those engines together, you have anywhere from about 40,000 pounds of thrust for that airplane as opposed to Boeing's 115,540 pounds of thrust. That's amazing. That's incredible.
Yes.
The lift power of those engines, and then I would imagine that I don't know about the 747 what engines they're using, but and also the A380, I believe, the Airbus, which is I guess at this point it's still the largest airplane, passenger-carrying airplane, that's in the air today. Any comments? Did I get some of the numbers right on the 727, you recall?
You're pretty close. I think it wasn't quite that much. It was about 11. But what really is astonishing is when the L-1011 came on the scene and it had the RB-211s on them, they were producing 43,000 pounds of thrust, and towards the end of their life cycle, so to speak, the RB-535 engine was developing almost 53,000 pounds of thrust. And just think, this engine is two times that thrust, and just one engine. It is amazing.
Yeah.
This is something that I think anybody that's in the aircraft or aviation field would just mind-boggling the statistics that come out of these airplanes.
I think I've heard that the new engines that they're using, the A380s, developed about 90,000 pounds of thrust, 90,000 or 95,000 pounds of thrust each. That's phenomenal.
That's phenomenal.
I call them the Trent engines, I believe.
Right. That's exactly right.
Neil, John, I think that the all-time hot rod has to be still the 757.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that thing would leap up to the sky with, you know, you could haul that thing up to 30 degrees nose up and still accelerate.
Yeah.
I think at 43,000 aside. But.
You know, it was so funny when I first got on that airplane and I got my mother-in-law right out of the way. I had a solo flight, of course, with a co-pilot, first officer, and the passengers, and we went down to Fort Myers. And early in the morning after we landed there, we had a layover, and early in the morning we took off. And Fort Myers, had just a few flights that had gone in there. And the tower asked what kind of performance we could get out of that airplane. I said, "Well, if you wouldn't restrict us down on the departure, if we can climb right on up to altitude, I think I can demonstrate that." It was a beautiful, clear morning. And normally we derated the power on takeoff. So I used the not derated power, but the normal max power on the darn thing on takeoff. And that airplane was climbing so fast that I had to uncouple the autopilot because I did engage the autopilot. And, I mean, it was climbing to altitudes unknown. And it kind of frightened me, really.
That was a hot rod, baby.
It really was, yeah. And, of course, I always enjoyed flying out of St. Thomas with that short runway of 4,700 feet and the mountain there. And, of course, they wanted the captains to do all the takeoff and landings there because of the length of the runway and the mountains that you had to clear. And, of course, that airplane had no problem clearing mountains. It was a phenomenal airplane. It really was.
Neil, this is Steve. I think our listeners would be interested in your describing your phrase there, your mother-in-law ride. You might explain that for our listeners.
Well, mother-in-law, of course you did a lot of those, Steve, because you were a check captain, and of course you did one that went down in history as the mother-in-law ride of all mother-in-law rides. And that was a flight of 585, is that the number,
855.
Steve? 855, I always get that wrong. But yeah, mother-in-law ride is when a brand new captain on that airplane checks out, and he really gets a rating on the airplane and is type rated on that airplane by the FAA and has a license and has never been on the airplane to fly it. All the flying and the air work and everything is done in the simulator. But they require 25 hours of having a check captain ride in the right seat as the first officer in the case of the 757, because it's only a two-seat airplane. And so the check captain rides in the right seat, and the captain flies 25 hours. But those 25 hours can be reduced for every correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, but for every takeoff and landing, I think you can reduce an hour off the 25.
That's what I remember, yes.
Yeah. And so after 25 hours, the check captain says, okay, you're clear to solo here now. It's all yours. And that's a good feeling when you have been signed off and now you're a captain of that airplane. And they do that on all the airplanes. I'm not certain whether the program is still like that today because, it's been over 20 years since we've flown with Eastern Airlines. But you know, I also think that all these new airplanes, if Eastern was still in business, I wonder how many of the new airplanes that Boeing is flying anyhow, because Eastern was, they favored Boeing airplanes. I wonder how many airplanes Eastern would have been the first, because we did fly so many different airplanes. We were the first carrier that operated the 727, the L-1011, and the A-300 over here in America. We were the first carrier. So
there is a phrase going around now, and that's it, that says that if it ain't Boeing, I ain't going.
Yeah. Well, I did have a little poem I was going to read, but I decided I'm not going to read that. I've got an interesting story that I found in the retired Eastern Airlines pilot magazine that's called Repartee. And in that magazine, I was the editor for about 5 years. I found a couple of really good stories that were told by Eastern pilots and flight attendants, and this particular story was reported in one of the magazines that I was the editor, and I thought it was a good story. But Cecile, would you do the honors of that story?
Well, okay, this is Cecile.
Okay,
sorry,
Cecile, Charlie.
She's
a deeper voice,
having a sneeze attack and having a real tough time right now, so she asked if I could jump in for a minute so she can regroup and stop from coughing and sneezing. So I'm going to do her bit.
Go ahead.
I won't do it as well, but I'm going to give it a go. Okay. Here's a story appearing in an issue of Repartee magazine written by an Eastern stewardess. Okay. I guess you call them flight attendants today. Wasn't that sort of sexist? Okay. Eastern stewardess. About air rage. Air rage is not necessarily a contemporary phenomenon. I would imagine that it's been going on since 1914 when the airboat line began its first regularly scheduled passenger flights between Tampa and St. Pete. The fare was $5 for a gross weight of 200 pounds, including luggage. But the only thing I can see, and I'm reading the part of the writer here, so it's not I, obviously. Okay. About the only thing I can see going wrong here might be a dispute at the counter weigh-in. Madam, there will be an added charge of $2 for a weight overage. Whatever do you mean, young man, says the indignant passenger. Madam's luggage weighs 28 pounds, which places you 17 pounds over our limits. While serious huffing and no doubt in-air complaints for the duration of the flight between the adjacent cities for sure. The first airline meal is alleged to have been a prepackaged something or another aboard a KLM flight between London and Paris in 1919. Maybe the malady began its festering then. At the moment, unable to translate, I'm supposed to eat this, whatever it is, into Dutch. And during the run of my career as a flight attendant for Eastern Airlines in the late 50s, there were very few incidents of passengers going berserk in flight. When a ruckus did occur, alcohol was usually involved, either too much or not enough. Liquor kits, large trays filled with miniature booze bottles, along with mixers and fruity adornments, were regularly loaded into the galleys of our four-engine aircraft, even though Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, our manager in charge of everything, was by that time a teetotaler. On our Golden Falcon first-class flights, booze was free with a two-drink limit. On the four-engine Silver Falcon coach flights, it was, if I'm recalling correctly, $1 a bottle. I doubt there was any profit involved with in-flight alcohol service. It was just a case of keeping up with the competition. And it was a pain in the patoot. As a non-drinker myself in those days, the art of mixology was a bit of a problem until I found out the cherries did not go into the pre-mixed martinis, nor did rocks refer to something we picked up in a tire tread while taxiing. Flight 127 was a constellation, no-frills coach flight that left Chicago's Midway at 6 o'clock every evening, carrying a load of tired and thirsty businessmen back to Raleigh-Durham after a hard day at the merchandise mart. Not a bad trip to work. Ice was loaded in the buckets by the same folks who catered our meals. There must have been a new guy on duty the day we taxied from the gate, Cubeless. I was new, too, been flying the line for only about 2 weeks. But as irony would have it, I was senior flight attendant on this trip. The junior was my roommate, who happened to be 2 weeks behind me. We'd gone through training together, but because Lily had graduated 2 weeks shy of her 21st birthday, she was junior to me, and that made me responsible for the back end of the 70-passenger Lockheed 749, and I blew it. Moments after leaving the gate with a full load, I discovered the lack of ice. We searched the entire airplane as we taxied. No go. The only ice that was liable to show up on this trip would be the stuff that showed up every once in a while on the leading edge of the wings, where it was quickly broken up by a boot and plunger system and sent careening back to thwack against the fuselage. Sometimes this sound made passengers a bit edgy, but not as edgy as they were going to be, I feared, when I confessed we had no ice on board except a handful of rapidly melting cubes that I might be able to fish out of the drinking water jug. Flight 127 was queued up for takeoff about number four, which gave me just enough time to make a complete ass of myself by sticking my head into the cockpit, always secured in the open position for takeoff and landing in those days, and announcing to the grumpiest captain on the Chicago base that we had no ice. It still isn't clear to me what I expected him to do about it. Taxi across a couple of grass strips back to the gate for bucket ice? Take a departure delay? The captain said nothing. His look told all. I was mortified, particularly since I had the big eyes for his co-pilot, but that's another story. Okay, I thought, this is it. The passengers will stone me. We will land with a full liquor kit, and passenger service will ask embarrassing questions that in order to answer, I would have to tell big fat lies, like, geez, what did you expect? I had 70 Baptist preachers on board coming back on the previous flight, discussing the evils of alcohol. Well, instead, I decided to face the music. I got on the PA and confessed. Ladies and gentlemen, I am the senior flight attendant on this trip. While I know how to put out fires, administer oxygen, and would be able to give you the nomenclature and location of each wing star, I apparently am not smart enough to have double-checked the galley for ice. So we have two options. Martinis, I explained, were available shaken or stirred and slightly chilled until the ice cubes melted, or for the ultra-sophisticated, warm whiskey with cold water or tepid soda. A little over a couple hours later, we touched down in Raleigh-Durham. Along with my "don't stand up now because you'll fall down" announcement, I thanked the passengers for their patience and participation, and they'd left a big dent in the liquor kit. They applauded and thanked Lily and me for a great trip. The only air rage involved was the captain, who snidely asked if we'd sold any drinks at just about the same time the agent walked into operations with a kid under his arm. "Man," he exclaimed, "your passengers knocked the socks off this one." I just smiled, signed in, then headed for the hotel. And that was written by Eastern flight attendant stewardess Elizabeth Schuett, and she writes for Cox News Service. Back to you.
The following was submitted and printed by Repartee Magazine. The author of this story is Pete Vandersloos. On October 29th, 1972, I was scheduled for a DC-9 flight six-month instrument check. The captain was Dan Morrison. We met at Newark Airport around 11 p.m., and the check ride was to fly to Dulles and make the following approaches: normal ILS front and rear, plus ADF and VOR, both single and multi-engine and V1 cuts, and single-engine go-arounds. Of course, we had the normal emergency procedures, engine fire and failure, electrical emergency, plus pressurizing problems. After the approach work, we climbed to 12,500 feet and headed back to Newark to do the air work. It was a beautiful night, but very cold. We went over North Philadelphia at 12,500 feet. It was now time for the stall series. We checked the stick shaker and the stall warning, that then looked up to the speed and set the airspeed bug for a clean stall. The speed was 147 knots for the stick shaker to activate. We set the engine power to 65% of N1, and with the aircraft clean, no flaps or leading edge devices. As the aircraft slowed down, we continued to trim the elevator up to take up the elevator pressures. We stopped trimming at 160 knots as the aircraft slowed to 147 knots, and the stick shaker and stall warning did not go off. I asked the check captain what he should do. He said, "Just hold it and see what happens." It was very smooth air. I kept holding back, and pressure and the pitch angle gradually increased to about 40 degrees, and at 107 knots, the left wing dropped vertically, and the nose dropped off to about 70 degrees nose down. I went to full power, and I called for takeoff power, and the check captain said, "How about the leading edge devices?" So I said, "Leave them in. I think we might exceed 280 knots, which is their maximum airspeed." I initiated a graduating rolling pullout. The altimeter needles were going around so fast you could not read them. Trying to do my best, I did not overstress the airplane and recover in flight before we hit the ground and managed to level off at 3,500 feet at 320 knots. I believe from the stall-till recovery that was 5 seconds, I said to Dan, "Want to climb up and redo that again?" He said, "Let's go home." On the ground at Newark, Dan said to me, "I won't tell anyone if you won't." At this time, the upset I was flying shows regularly in teaching aerobatics in my T-6 type aircraft. I felt this knowledge was helpful to recover from the upset. Having been there and done that, I agree with him.
The DC-3 display in the Hall of Air Transportation made its last commercial flight on October 12, 1952, when it flew from San Salvador to Miami. By then, it had flown more than 56,700 hours. The DC-3 has proven itself the most popular transport airplane ever built. Dr. Phil Gerber, historian emeritus of the Aerospace Museum of Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., and speaker at the 1981 Repart Convention held in Denver, Colorado, made these remarks in the October, November, December 1981 issue of Repart. "I remember when Captain Eddie came to Washington in a new Connie. I went to see him then and to see the new Connie. I said, 'Captain Eddie, we're giving up the DC-3. He said, "Yep. Well, I would like to have one for the museum." "All right," the captain said. I said, "Would you pick me out a good one that has a real interesting history?" "Yep," he said. I went back to my office, and there was a letter from American Airlines saying they were first to use the DC-3. I went to see Captain Eddie and told him that I wouldn't need the DC-3 from him, as American Airlines had one for us. "The hell you say," Captain Eddie remarked. "Go to the museum now and see Fly Eastern Airlines. It's the biggest advertisement they have for miles around. Captain Eddie was the one who gave it to us." 21 of these giant Douglas planes make up the Great Silver Fleet, which flies daily scheduled between New York and Miami, Chicago and Miami, New York, Atlanta, New Orleans, and Houston. Eastern Airlines service between New York, Washington, flying time 80 minutes, is the most frequent airplane service in the world. And
well,
I'd like to make a comment, if it's okay with everybody.
Yeah.
As you know, my father was one of the 12 original managers of Eastern Airlines and worked through World War II. And the plane that's hanging in the Smithsonian, I asked my father before he passed away some years if he recognized the tail number on the airplane. And he said he sure did, because Captain Eddie was on that airplane and stopped at his station, and they had dinner together. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting story, that my dad told me over the years.
Huh.
Any announcements?
Well, just a couple of comments about the stories that we've read tonight. One about the flight attendant and the liquor kit. And I'll never forget, I think I've told this, I know I have probably, but I'm going to tell it again. And it was, I was temporarily based up in New York, fly shuttle, and they didn't have enough pilots, so I bid to go to New York for, I think it was 3 months that I was there. And it was the winter of 1978 when they had one of the worst snowstorms ever recorded up there. I don't know. Maybe this year's beat of the storm of 1978. But the blizzard of 78. I think I even had got a T-shirt with that on it. But one of my flights out of LaGuardia on the 727, I introduced myself to the crew, and I knew nothing about shuttle flying at that time. And just like the rest of them, I signed the papers and went out to the airplane. And the engineer had done the pre-flight, and the flight attendant came up after I seated myself in the captain's seat. And she said, "Captain," she said, "do you have any instructions for me?" And I said, "Not that I can think of." Why do you ask? She said, "Well, I usually ask the captain if there's anything special." And I said, "Well, thank you very much." I said, "Oh, by the way," yes, she had just about turned around and walked out. And I said, "Oh, yeah, there is one thing." And I said, "We might be flying over some water, but if we do and we have to ditch the airplane, would you please get the liquor kit and get in my raft?" And I thought that was kind of funny. But after she went to the back, co-pilot said, "You know who that flight attendant was?" And I said, "Well, she was a senior flight attendant." And I said, he said, "Yes, but she was also one of the only survivors on flight 66, which crashed at Kennedy Airport in that severe downdraft that put the airplane down." And later on, I talked to her when we got to our point and we had to do a turnaround, and apologized, and she said, no. I said, and we got to be talking a little bit about that accident, and she said that the thing that really saved her was the blue water. And I said, "What do you mean, blue water?" And she said, "Well, I was sitting in the aft section in the two seats for the flight attendants that was mounted on the aft air stair door. And, of course, the airplane broke apart, and that's part of the airplane turned upside down, and she got all the water out of the Johns, and she said saved her because there was fire on the airplane. But interesting about things that you hear a story like the liquor kit and no ice cubes, and I'm sure we can all think of a story or two about drinks on the airplanes. Another one was the one that Chuck, you did one on the historical flight up on the DC-3, and Dr. Garber, Paul Garber, was the historian at the Air Space Museum, Smithsonian Institute, and his convention speech that was done for REPA's convention in 1981 was a really great, great speech. I can recall he gave, and I think we did a show on that early in our radio broadcasting history here, and it was about the 10 greatest airplanes that Dr. Garber recalled being the historian at the Air Space Museum. And it was a great, great article. But a lot of great stories. And folks, if anyone listening would like to join any of these organizations, the EARA, which is the Eastern Airlines Retiree Association, as affiliate members, even if you're not a retired Eastern employee, they welcome you to join that organization, you can go to EARA.org, I believe. I'm not certain whether their website is up or not, but I know they're putting together that it was down for a while. But REPA is REPA, which is the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, and they take affiliate members. And they also have some great magazines. And we put together about 35 years of Eastern magazines. And in these magazines were historical articles and a lot of humor, a lot of even tragic stories in the magazine that were told by former Eastern employees, mechanics, flight attendants, pilots, and a lot of great stories and history there. So from time to time, we do take a few stories out of that magazine. Any other comments, host? We sure hope George catches some fish. Charlie, how's fishing? Have you been fishing?
Are you talking to Charlie?
Yeah, Charlie. Yeah, you're a great fisherman.
Yeah, I got the field sucked in. I got her drinking these air. What do you call those things? Airborne. I got her drinking those little fizzies until she's about to pass out here. So hopefully we'll get her well. I'll tell you a funny, quick little air story. I don't have much to add on air story, but back in the day when I was married and had a real life, I had business out in Montana. And my then-wife flew out with me, and we had to charter this little – my then-wife flew out with me, and we chartered this little plane because we had to look at a half-section land out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they still film movies out there for cowboys on the wooden bars and stuff on the side of the village, you know, the towns. And it was way out in the middle of nowhere. So we're flying out there in this little, I guess, four-seater, and the pilot said, "We'll go down and look at this antelope. We say there's some antelope down there." Yeah. So he goes, "Yeah." He banks and turns and does this dive. Yeah. We buzz these antelope. It was pretty cool. I'm snapping pictures. He zooms back up. And I'm turned around behind me. I said, "Hey, that was pretty cool." I looked at my wife, and she was green. Now, she's going to get sick. But I've never seen a person really phosphorescent, day glow green before. She was green. So I guess you guys have seen it now. I've seen some seasick people get a little bit green. She was as green as a Coke bottle, I tell you. Oh, yeah. So that's about my living on flying stories. But, yeah, the fish has been real hot down here. We have 2 days ago a boat went out, had a 5 or 6 sailfish releases, and 140 pounds of dolphin on board by the time they came in.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it is heating up. And, in fact, I was talking to Bobby Boyle, who's one of the preeminent guys down here, world-class guy, and he attended our club and gave a little bit of a speech on tuna fishing over in the Bahamas, and that's just starting, big yellowfin tuna fishing, and he gave some great pointers on that. So up around Isaacs, sort of in the channel up there toward Lucaya, starting now for the next couple of months or so, 60-80 pound yellowfin tuna can be had almost for the taking if you can get them to come up and make it happen. They'll just load up on you. So yeah, things are looking good for now. I wish I could get out and do some of them.
Well, maybe we'll get a fishing report from George Jen from Panama.
This is Steve. Can anybody hear me?
Yeah, I hear you, Steve.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I was
you got a comment?
Just going to make a comment. I didn't. Yeah, I was just going to talk about the DC-3. That is one of the finest airplanes that pilots have ever flown, and I think it is one that should be required. Pilots should be required to be proficient in before they get their multi-engine license. They should be able to demonstrate proficiency in a DC-3. And it's the greatest training airplane, twin-engine training airplane that I think was ever built.
You're talking about a tailwheel airplane, which is a conventional geared airplane called tailwheel.
That's
airplane.
Correct.
Conventional gear.
Yeah.
We have area code 770. That sounds like it might be Bob Furman. Is that you, Bob? Well,
that's Sonny Smith with Gamut 770.
Hey, Sonny. Yeah.
Good evening to y'all.
Good evening. How are things in Atlanta, GA?
Things in Atlanta are good. You know, I just wanted to make one comment. You know, in the Atlanta terminal, I'm sure y'all are aware that they had a wall plaque that had all the Eastern pilots on there. You know, that right now they have all Eastern pilots on there.
Yeah.
And I don't know if y'all knew that or not, but every time I go by there, I have to look at them. But I mean, it's every pilot that ever flew for Eastern Airline is on that plaque.
Sonny, is it in a good location where passengers can easily see it, or do you have
it
to
is.
Go
it's
around
right
the
on
corner?
It's right on the side of the wall between around AirTran there. But I mean, it's got every pilot. It's got your name on there.
Yeah.
I mean, every Eastern pilot that's ever flew for Eastern is on there. And it's just, you know, when you walk by that and you see that, it's just, I have to stop every time I walk by it to sit there and look at it. It's sort of an honor to the pilots of Eastern Airlines.
Yeah. I remember being on the board of directors with REPA at the time. Captain Gene Stevens from Miami, was taking care of that wall. Every time an Eastern pilot passed away, we made at the end of the year, all of those names of pilots passing away that year were put on a bronze plaque, and these things were huge tablets. And finally got to the point that at one of the meetings here a few years ago, that it was decided that they would take that down and put up, because after all of us will be gone one day, they theorized, and they decided that we'd put all the names of all pilots that we could identify on that plaque. And the credit really goes to Jerry Frost, who really worked very hard, Captain Jerry Frost, and he's the treasurer of Eastern Retiree Pilots Association, and he did a great job in getting names together to be put on that plaque. Wonderful plaque.
I'll tell you, you see people, when I walk by there, you see people standing there looking at it. And again, just like you say, it's every person that ever flew for Eastern Airlines is on there. And it's really, you know, there's a lot of history there. A lot of people don't remember Eastern Airlines, but when you see that, it's an emotional thing.
Yeah, that's great.
Neil?
Yes,
Neil,
Cecile.
Neil is back here. Jim Hart, are you on? Jim?
Yes, I am, Cecile.
Okay. Beverly, in our luncheon that we have on once a month, has her husband's work is on West Palm Beach Airport being exhibited. It's a wooden carving that he did. It's like a painting, but it's made out of special wood. Jim,
it's a nature scene. Yes, it's a nature scene.
A nature scene. He was a former Eastern employee. What was his name, Jim?
Richard.
Richard.
Newland.
And it's being exhibited for the next 3 months at West Palm Beach Airport. So if anybody flies through there, you might want to take a look at it. It's beautiful workmanship.
Yes.
You know, the retired employees, period, of Eastern Airlines have loved that company so much that they do things like this. And I don't know of any other airline that that is recognized in so many different ways by its employees. And even though it's not flying, it's out of business for 20-plus years, we still keep talking about the airlines.
Neil, this is John. I just wanted to make note that another great airline in history has gone by the wayside last Thursday, World Airways out of Peachtree City, Georgia. World flew for 63 years and was founded by Ed Daly, who, if you remember in a historical photo, when they were evacuating Da Nang in Vietnam, Daly stood there with a 38 on the air stair of a 727. And they had, I think, the 243 passengers on that airplane, standing room only.
Wow.
World has been a huge charter carrier in the United States for, as I said, for 63 years, and it's a shame to see them go because they were one of the best.
And, John, you indicated that it was probably the winding down of our military charter flights, which was one of their biggest businesses, I believe.
Yes, it was. They did a lot of business with the U.S. military. They did a lot of, they did a lot of flights. I used to use them for charter flights with my travel agency, and there was, at one point in time, I couldn't charter an airplane because they were so booked that far into the future, but the economy is terrible, and the fuel prices are even worse, and unfortunately, another great airline bites the dust.
Too bad.
Yeah. Well, I think I hear the music, Jim.
Yeah, I seem to hear the same champagne music, Neil, in the background. So I guess we must bring this show to a close. From all of our hosts, it's been great being with you tonight, and we hope that you'll continue listening to the voice of Eastern Airlines Radio throughout the year. And so, from all of us here at the EAL Radio Show until next week, keep the blue side up, have plenty of airspeed and plenty of altitude, and may all of your landings be grease jobs. Good night, Eastern family.
Good night, Eastern family.
Good night.
Good night.